I was interested today to talk a little bit about settling on oneself. One of the ways of understanding the whole path of meditation practice is that it's a progressive settling on oneself. And I think it's helpful to have some appreciation for all the ways in which we don't settle on ourselves. All the ways we're ahead of ourselves or behind ourselves or not ourselves at all. That last week we talked about desire. And one of the fascinating things about desire is that when we're filled with desire and directing ourselves towards the object of desire, that I don't think we're ever really settled on ourselves in the present moment. Desire is about something you're going to get. It could be in a moment or a minute or a day or a year. But the mind is subtly directed or grossly directed in front of itself or ahead, looking ahead. And when the mind is looking ahead or thinking ahead, imagining ahead into the future to some anticipated result, then that part of the mind is not really able to settle on itself or settle with itself or be present for itself, listen to itself in a deep way. Same thing with anxiety. You know, much of anxiety has a lot to do with our imagination. We're often anxious about things that are potential consequences or potential possibilities in the future. We don't really know often what's going to happen in the future. But we anticipate certain things might happen with our imagination, and then we get anxious. That's one source of anxiety. And that kind of in living in the future, what might happen, certainly has some usefulness to help negotiate life, but to get lost in there, it prevents us from settling on ourselves, to being present for ourselves, in ourselves, as we are at this moment. And the possibility exists for each of us to live a life where we're settled on ourselves. We're not ahead of ourselves or behind ourselves, not resisting ourselves, not afraid of who we are, not hiding ourselves from ourselves or from others, but rather a feeling at home in ourselves, or at home is probably a good word, at home in ourselves or in comfort with ourselves, to find that we have a home that we carry with us everywhere in our own bodies. Many people have the experience of going home, perhaps, and feeling really, you know, finally I'm home, I can kind of unwind or just be myself and kick back or whatever. And it's kind of off. So some people, a nourishing place, unless they have a 2-year-old at home. And so people settle on themselves, you know, at home. But the idea is, can you bring that homeness with you everywhere you go? What would it take to feel at home in oneself? And I think it's possible to have that. There's a beautiful sound clip I heard of Suzuki Roshi, where he's talking about how he really trusts his feet. The thing he trusts the most in his life is he trusts his feet and he trusts his cushion, his meditation cushion. Because when he's standing, he just stands there. He's standing and really settled on the ground, connected to the ground, and he arises, his sense of presence arises out of being in that moment, at that place, at that time, on the ground in his feet, standing or walking. Or when he's sitting, meditation, which he did a lot, he's sitting on his little round cushion, and he trusts his cushion, or trusts his butt, I guess. He's just right here, he's fully here, he's not trying to be somewhere else. And a sense of life and being alive arises out of this trusting or being present here for what's here right now. I was really pleased today that I heard I was talking to another Buddhist teacher, and he heard from one of his teachers, actually I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh, something that I heard, almost the same words that I heard from a completely different Zen teacher, no connection to Thich Nhat Hanh. And both teachers had told both of us, basically slightly different wording, but something like, just to be alive is enough. Or I think Thich Nhat Hanh said it, just to be alive, just to be is enough. To be settled on ourselves, to find some kind of trust in our feet, or a trust in our cushions, in our posture, in our presence, that here we are. And maybe here we are is not always comfortable or pleasant, but can you be here for it? Can you be just here right now? Thinking is beautiful. I love my thought, my thinking process. But I know that thinking itself, when I'm living in my thoughts, that really prevents me from settling on myself. Because to settle on myself, there has to be some ability to be broader or wider in my presence than I can be if I'm lost or preoccupied with my thinking. So can my sense of presence be broad enough and wide enough so that it includes my thinking, doesn't have to exclude it? So one of the ways of talking about settling on oneself or finding oneself is to think of concentric circles. And as one of the common expressions in our circles is we start where we're at. You know, we don't start where we want to be. You know, you might never get there. Especially in meditation, if you're so preoccupied with a goal, then that'll just get in the way of reaching the goal. So, but think of a concentric circles. And maybe the easiest way of settling oneself is to take the widest sense of who we are in any given moment or any given time, and just kind of really be kind of maybe expansive and just include all of who we are, not just simply who, you know, this particular feeling right now, or this particular idea, or this particular hope or agenda that we have, but even the broadest, widest sense, you know, of our history, even our, you know, the past experience of our life that inform us who we are right now, and the past generations that of who we are, our background, our ethnic background, our racial background, our family and social background, or, you know, our gender, or our, you know, our family and our family situation, just a whole big slew of stuff, and just take it all into account. And not to hold, not to brace ourselves or deny or hold anything apart, but what's the biggest, widest sense of who you are you can have? That's one way of starting, thinking of the really wide concentric circle. Who's who you are in the widest, biggest sense? And then can you accept that? Can you listen to that? Can you be present for that? And some people will find that that's maybe a really easy way to begin being in the present moment, to have this really broad sense of who they are. Because if we're denying parts of ourselves or not accepting parts of ourselves, it's really hard to settle in ourselves. So sometimes it's useful to begin really broadly. I remember some 5-6 years ago we did a death and dying workshop here in Palo Alto. I did it together with Paul Haller, who's a Zen Center priest. And he did a marvelous guided meditation where people sat and paired up with each other and sat kind of looking at each other, were present with each other for a little while. And then reflected when as they're looking at this person, that person shared some of the same human experiences that you've had. That person was born. That person experienced the difficulties of growing up that everyone experiences. That person had experienced difficulties of maybe losing someone to death, which everyone experiences sooner or later. That person had disappointments. That person had joys. That person had a lot of the universal experiences that we all have. And somehow seeing that kind of the person in their fundamental, important, key elements of their life were not any different than oneself. If the parents aren't dead, the parents are going to die, just like, you know, it's happened to me, or it's going to happen to me, or whatever. And in the course of doing this meditation, I think the sense some people had was the sense of loving kindness and compassion, the sense of openness and acceptance of the other person was really profound and deep. To see the other person not as a stranger, not as a, you know, as a them, but see them in some deep way, some deep empathetic way, as being similar to who we are. And then in reverse order, to see ourselves then as being, you know, the particular dramas that we get so caught up in, and this relationship, this experience, this health problem, this job, this whatever, as important as they are, there can be this great broader sense of preciousness of our humanity, our common humanity, to realize that our particular unique experiences are part of this great big ocean of common human life that we all share. For some people, that kind of exercise helps them to kind of begin to settle in the present moment. If there isn't that kind of broad acceptance of who they are, it's really hard to kind of be present for who we actually are, right? But think of these concentric circles, and then we bring the circle closer. What is the experience we have right now? And not to be ahead of ourselves with some idea that, oh, in meditation I'm supposed to be going for this particular kind of experience, or I'm supposed to kind of narrow my attention and my breath and just do this for right now. But rather just, in this moment, what's actually happening in a broad way for me right now? Is it mostly I'm in my thinking, a lot of thoughts and concerns, is it mostly feelings that are going on? Is it mostly hopes and aspirations that are going on for me? Is it mostly a lot of body sensations or a combination of all these? What's actually happening here? What do I have to open to in broad sense of the present moment to be present for myself as I am? And again, if we're ahead of ourselves and trying to get someplace or narrowing our attention too quickly, we leave ourselves behind. But if we have these wide, kind of broad sense of concentric circles of just accepting ourselves as we are and actually recognizing who we are, then it's like we're creating this foundation that allows us to go deeper and deeper, foundations allow you to go higher and higher. You create this big acceptance of who you are in the broad sense, and that lets you go higher and more and more subtle aspects of who you are. And the idea is to bring it all together, to settle ourselves on ourselves. And many of us have our different aspects of our life going in different directions. We're not particularly, we're fragmented beings, many of us. And what I like to say often, you've heard me say, is that if you're sitting here in this room at this time in this body, and you're thinking about what happened at work today, your mind and your body are in the different places at the same time. And the idea is what does it take to bring them together, the body and the mind? And what it takes is to somehow recognize what is the most predominant thing that's going on right now. Not to be ahead of yourself and say, well, I'm supposed to be focusing on the breath. But notice, the predominant thing is I'm thinking about work. Okay, there's some broad way you can kind of recognize and see and listen to that event, that without getting caught up in those thoughts, without living in those thoughts, to listen in a kind of deep way, in the way you'd listen to a friend, when you listen even below the content of what they're saying. Or perhaps there's some body sensation. You could show up and you're tense. Busy day and shoulders are tense, the jaws are tense, stomach is tense. And so rather than kind of avoiding that and saying, well, I shouldn't pay attention to that because good meditators don't have tense shoulders, so I'm not going to pay attention to that. Just kind of, oh, here I am. This is what's happened. This is the predominant experience of who I am right now, is tension in my shoulders. And just to kind of then to just take that, the widest concentric circle of what's really happening for you now. And then start bringing these things together, bring it into the body. What's happening in the body as you feel this? What's happening in the body as you think all these thoughts? And to begin bringing it in, then what's happening really in the body? The body, let the body be the container. Maybe that's the next concentric circle. And then as we do this, we get more and more settled on ourselves. So we bring all the fragmented pieces together, all the dispersed ways in which we're concerned about different things and different activities, and all the ways in which we resist ourselves, all kind of a chance to kind of settle inwards. And we settle and settle and settle. And we find ourselves then content and happy at home right here. Here we are. Is this enough just to be here now? And I think one of the phenomenally transformative things to experience in meditation is that you need so little in life to be deeply happy or deeply at peace with yourself. You need so phenomenally little. It doesn't have to depend on relationships. It doesn't have to depend on jobs. It doesn't have to depend on money or status. It doesn't have to depend on much at all. There's a phenomenally deep peace. I would say some of the deepest peace a human being can experience, that is most easily accessible in the quiet of settling on oneself in meditation when nothing else is needed. But if you're ahead of yourself, thinking, well, that's what I want, is that deeply settled, contented place, then you're leapfrogging ahead of who you actually are. You have to let this thing kind of settle. You have to settle yourself on yourself and let that find itself, let yourself find that peace by having this broad acceptance. You can't jump over who you are. There's no spiritual bypasses are not recommended. So the classic image of this kind of settling, perhaps one classic image, is that of a pond settling. And that if you go to a muddy pond and you want to have clarity and peace in the pond, you don't bring a stick with you and stir up the pond some more. You don't take some big stick and kind of try to push all the mud over to that side of the pond so you can see over here, you know, try to order those little mud particles, you know, to get more organized, you know, and tell them what to do. But rather what you do is you get out of the way. You sit there on maybe the edge of the pond and just don't stir it up anymore. Don't get agitated. Don't try to make anything happen. And the pond will settle by itself. And eventually everything will become crystal clear in the pond. So the same way with our sitting practice. The idea is to have this broad, you have to be in the present moment. There's no way of avoiding that. But getting yourself in the present moment is a lot easier if you have this broad acceptance of who you are in the present moment. And if you have this broad acceptance of who you are in the present moment, then you're also in the present moment. So to bring yourself in the present moment, and then in a radical way, can you just accept that without needing it to be any different? Even what you don't like, even what you don't want to look at, just, oh, here it is. I'll open to that also. And then see what happens. And don't be ahead of yourself trying to make something happen or trying to rush some kind of solution or some kind of insight. But then let things just kind of settle on their own. And I think one of the phenomenal things is that the more skilled you are in meditation, in leaving yourself alone, so you can settle on yourself, so the self can settle on itself, the quicker the transformation is. So if you don't try to make a transformation, you don't try to change yourself at all, you try to accept you as you are, but the more thorough you can do that, the better, more skilled you get at doing that, the quicker you actually settle onto this phenomenal stillness, phenomenal sense of loving kindness or compassion or well-being that is waiting inside of each of us if we just, you know, listen very deeply to what's there and let what's there settle on itself. So I think it's useful for people, to all of us, to reflect and think about the ways in which we are not present for ourselves, the ways in which we're not settled on ourselves, and to think and to reflect and think about the course of the day, the way you live your life and activities you do. Are there times in your day when you're particularly not settled on yourself, when you're particularly away from yourself? And does it make any sense to find some ways to remind yourself or encourage yourself to be more settled on yourself in those activities? A very small example is I spend time on the computer, and I've noticed I can have different postures in front of the computer, and I can be standing typing on the computer, quite settled on myself. Find a good posture, have a good chair, and kind of align basically, and just kind of, you know, working away. And I can feel quite contented, and it works quite well. But then if I get a little bit frustrated with the writing, how it's going, or a little bit kind of, you know, doesn't take much, I find myself kind of ahead of myself, or if I'm in a hurry to write, or I'm trying to squeeze out of my mind the wording of a sentence or something. Or there's all these ways in which I very easily lose myself, and I can feel it in my posture. And I'll start leaning over that keyboard and leaning, straining as if, you know, the answers are going to pop out of this monitor. And so it's a small example of a place where I try to pay attention to how well I'm settled on myself or how poorly I am. And it's very clear to me what it feels like not to be settled on myself. And I'll come back and sit the best I can in a more aligned posture. So those are my thoughts for today, settling ourselves on ourselves. And what are your questions or comments? Yes.
I find myself, you know, striving so much to, like, I don't know, follow this path or whatever, and you know, learn the teachings of the Buddha, and I don't know, just like trying to make myself something other, and I don't know, I mean, maybe it's just always going to be attention or something, but it just feels like I often, it's so easy to find things where I don't fully accept, because I say, you know, oh, well, you know, a good Buddhist would not be upset if this or that, or do this or that. Or, I don't know if you want to say anything about
that. Oh, this is a great topic. Anybody who's involved with spiritual practice will struggle with some degree with what you're talking about. And we have, you know, spirituality often sets up as my ideal of how you is a good way of being, what you're trying to be, and then we measure ourselves against that. We try to do spiritual bypasses and get ahead of ourselves, and we kind of shut off part of who we are. And so, I mean, I can imagine a so-called good Buddhist getting angry, and then feeling that in being angry, that's wrong, because Buddhists don't get angry, of course, right? They're supposed to be kind people. So they could just kind of deny that parts of themselves. Well, I'm not going to be that way, and force themselves to be some way different. And that just kind of doesn't work, because that just kind of puts our anger in the subterranean caverns of our life, just ready to pop up some other way. The other way is to, and we don't want to accept it in a sense of, oh, it's fine, I'm just going to continue kind of flipping everyone off that I see, and let's find more people I can get angry with, and good Buddhist accepts their anger, and let's just do it really well, you know. But rather, okay, let me bring my attention to this. And let me, here, I'm an angry person right now, I feel anger. Let me bring my attention carefully to this anger, and feel it and sense it as it is, and be with it, and bring presence to that anger. Not to push it away, not to act on it, but to learn from it, and by entering into it without acting on it, to let there be a settling within it, and a clarifying and a purification happens within it. So there can be, you know, a movement towards greater kindness, but it's not by avoiding or repressing, but it's going into the anger and finding out what it's like to settle in the anger, to settle the anger on the anger.
Would you ever say if you had been upset, or maybe your example of anger earlier in the day, would you maybe then, reflect more deeply on that, even though it had already passed?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, yeah. There's a definitely important time in our life to spend a lot of time reflecting and thinking about things. The mindfulness practice is not reflective, but that doesn't mean that that's the only thing we're supposed to do. Is the reflection is a very important part of our life. It makes it much richer. When I first got seriously involved in Buddhist practice, I got involved in the San Francisco Zen Center, and there was a wonderful teacher there. I guess it's okay to say his name, because I have a lot of respect for him. Named Ed Brown. Maybe some of you know Ed Brown and his cookbooks. And he was the senior teacher, more or less, when I first arrived. And I was kind of in awe of him. And I was really taken by Zen practice. I really wanted to do Zen practice. And I saw this Ed Brown, who was like the shining example of, you know, Zen practice. I thought, great, you know. I thought, okay, if I'm going to be a Zen practitioner, the point is to be like Ed Brown. That's what it's all about. And so I went away for some time, and then I came back some year or so later, and to the Zen Center, and spent a little bit of time there, and I met some of the other senior priests, and I was kind of shocked to realize that they were not like Ed Brown. I said, maybe the point is not to be like Ed Brown. And maybe the point is to be myself. So I'm a slow learner. So then a little while later, I was sitting in a small little, I told this story many times, I was sitting in a small little sitting group, a Zen sitting group in Davis where I was going to school. We would sit twice a week, I think Mondays and Thursday evenings, we would sit for two periods of Zazen, two periods of meditation. And it was lovely. It was like three or four of us, you know, in this little bedroom turned into a Zendo. And in Zen, you sit with your eyes open and you sit facing the wall. So I was literally right up against the wall like this. And one day I sat down, took my good Zen posture, put my hands together, looked down, you know, kept my eyes open. And then this Roman column rose up in front of me. And so I don't know where the hallucinations stopped and where reality came in, but I'll tell you what my experience was. So this huge Roman column, you know, rose up in front of me, majestic, solid, you know, like the kind of thing you would trust your bank with, you know, like really serious, you know, solid, trustworthy column. And written in great Roman letters, kind of going down this column, were the letters, very impressively, were the letters Z-E-N. And then I went to embrace this wonderful column. And as I embraced it, it disappeared and my head fell against the wall of this little bedroom in Davis. That caught my attention. I usually don't hallucinate much when I meditate, so that was kind of a new thing. And I realized, thinking about that, that I had made Zen this great big thing, a great authority figure, great thing. I was supposed to become Zen. I was supposed to embrace Zen. And Zen was this great thing, this great institution that was all right and perfect and trustworthy, and I was supposed to just kind of enter and be a Zen student by studying Zen and being, you know. And I realized Zen doesn't exist at all. And the point of Zen practice, of Buddhist practice, was to study myself, not study this Buddhism out there. Forget about Buddhism. Settle on ourselves. And the point of Buddhist, all the Buddhist teachings, is not to help us be not ourselves, but the point of Buddhist teachings is to help us to really do the settling, really to meet ourselves. And it's like a mirror to help us see ourselves much better, more clearly. And as we see ourselves more clearly, then we'll settle on ourselves. The ultimate settling on itself is we let go of ourselves. When we're so at home in ourselves, so deeply entrusting to the present moment in ourselves here, there's no need to carry around any self-consciousness anymore. And we're just here, present. Yes?
That's a wonderful story in Davis. What I first flashed on when you were telling it was you were talking about how you were sitting in this perfect Zazen posture, as though you were the pedestal man. You know, because I notice a certain rigidity sometimes at Green Gulch with, you know, how some of those people are sitting. So, but it's a wonderful story.
Yes.
I was wondering about, you know, quieting the mind. You know, I find myself all the time, I've become much better as I've been doing the practice. You know, fantasizing, being in arguments over people, you know, just walking down the street. I'm wondering if, as you get deeper and deeper into the practice, can you actually turn off your internal dialogue, just not even in meditation, just walking down the street? Are you able to, is that
Article. It's a little bit. I don't know if I can answer you directly. I mean, probably I could answer and say yes, I can do that. But there are different degrees or levels or ways of thinking, you know, way a thought process works. You used the word inner dialogue. And certainly if I'm noticing I'm in a dialogue with my mind, kind of, it's much more kind of a coarser way of thinking. That if I want to, I could switch channels and think about something else, some other dialogue, or drop that entirely. But there's still thought going on. But it's not this kind of incessant, you know, following some theme or some associated thinking or some preoccupation. It's just, I can drop that pretty easily.
But you know, in meditation, if you just follow the breath, you can completely quiet and no thoughts. Can you do that? You're not able to do that? Or great people who have studied meditation are able to achieve that just walking down the street?
I'm not sure how to answer the question. I think it's important to say that the goal of meditation is not necessarily to have a mind empty of all thoughts. That's not maybe even particularly useful to have that. And so some people set that up as a goal, you know, partly because they're so irritated by all the thoughts they're having. They think the only alternative is to have completely shut it all off. And there is a middle way between, you know, it being crazy in there and it being off. And the alternative is not, you know, the music of thoughts either, you know. It's actually quite sublime. Some people will report, there are times that certainly there can be no thinking at all in meditation or in life, just complete no thinking at all. But there are... But a lot of people report the experience of meditation as having no thoughts, they're not thinking at all. And as I often have said, it can be quite cute because you can be sitting there in meditation and have this very subtle thought that says, I'm not thinking anything right now. And you believe it, even though you just had that thought saying that. Our thinking can be very, very subtle. And many people will say, my mind is really silent and empty. But actually, there's very, very subtle. They don't recognize how subtle the thinking process might be. It's kind of invisible to themselves. When I was practicing with Upandita, my teacher, one of the helpful advices I got from him was at some point where I thought my mind was really still, was he said, look really carefully and see if there's any more thoughts. There were. I was surprised. Plenty. But they're much more subtle. And when they get really, really subtle in meditation, their thoughts primarily have to do about what's happening in the present moment. And it's not even judging it or, you know, wanting it, just very subtle kind of, just, oh, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now. Yes?
I'm trying to understand better the balance between accepting who I am now and changing, because we all need to change constantly to some degree. As a practical level. And as a concrete example, I'm doing biofeedback and my practitioner is teaching me to breathe more slowly because I breathe too quickly. And so as I become aware of the breath, sometimes I think, I know I should be breathing more slowly, but at the same time, as you say, I know I should just let myself breathe as I'm breathing and be aware of it. So I'm trying to decide, in that example and others in general, should I attempt to control it sometimes in the day and let others just be as it is others?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's maybe most useful to think about the kind of mindfulness that we practice here and the kind of acceptance that's part of that mindfulness, to think of it as a strategy and not as a life philosophy or that this is not the right way you're supposed to always live. It's a particular strategy. It's a particularly skillful means that's useful. It's very useful and very powerful in its own domain. So when you're doing biofeedback, you know, you should follow the instructions your person is telling you. You know, forget about anything else, just do that. When you come here, forget what the biofeedback person tells you. Just do what, you know, we're doing here, you know, get with the program. there's different strategies which are useful and different. And part of the skill of, I think, of being a human being is to have a repertoire of these different skillful means that are useful and know when they're useful to use and when not. And there are many times in life that just simply not reacting and just kind of being present with an alert way, in a kind of accepting way, is really wise. And other times it's stupid.
Yeah,
Does this make some sense? Yes.
The thing about what the other gentleman said about walking down the street and kind of being taken up by your inner dialogue, that happens to me a lot. But I think if I look around me and just like a, obviously I'm not in the moment, if I'm thinking in my inner dialogue, if I just look around, what are the sights? What are the things going on around me? And just listen and smell and try to just
that's great, yeah. Feeling what's going on in your body. Yeah. Yes, Stephanie.
Changing and transforming are different. I mean, when you change, you're actually different. But when you transform, you're the same person that's evolving. And that, when you said to make it create a bigger identity of who you are, it really helped me realize, you know, that you don't change, you transform.
You mean like metamorphize? Like a caterpillar?
Yeah. Well, there's a difference.
Yeah. I guess change implies kind of slow change over time, and transformation requires some kind of a complete turning over, complete transformation, a complete metamorphosis, something like that. Is that what you mean?
That's yeah. What I got from
yeah.
You.
Yeah. There's a difference. Genevieve.
I was listening to what people were saying about change and what to do with thoughts that are, you know, in our minds and such. And I think that part of what the practice has done for me, it's not so much a matter of using the will to get rid of anything or to be different. It's a matter of just paying attention, you know, to what's happening in the present moment, if that's, you know, physically in my body or with my emotions or my thoughts, whatever it might be. And as a result of this, a lot of this other chatter starts falling away. It no longer serves a purpose.
That's nice.
And, you know, what you were saying about being plagued by your inner dialogue, you know, at one point in your life that was necessary. But that may not always be true. And part of what I'm hearing people saying is they're struggling with themselves, you know, where they are. And so much of the healing for me in this practice has been just really tune in, you know, to where I am right now. And have a trust, really have a trust that the transformation of the metamorphosis is happening every moment and right on schedule.
Yes.
As you have mentioned earlier, in one of the lectures that in Buddhism, like one of the members actually explained that he was a lawyer actually. I mean, he's a lawyer, and he had a difficult time in conforming with Buddhism at the same time, you know, practicing his law. How do you think the meditation helped you and will help us in order to cope with this stress of, you know, conforming to both the practice in Buddhism and as well as working the practical flow of human life, practicality of life.
Uh-huh.
How do you think the meditation helps there? Does it help us change and conform to the practical world, or I mean, how do you think?
Uh-huh. It's a good question. I should clarify, probably, I think the only time I've talked about that story with the lawyer was a little bit different than you remembered it now. The lawyer wanted to be a serious practitioner of mindfulness of Buddhism. And he said in his particular firm or department or field of law or whatever, he was expected to lie. And he was asked, how can you lie? How can I lie and be a good practitioner, a good Buddhist at the same time?
Right.
Okay? And for him, the answer was, you can't. So it wasn't a matter of, you know, being more mindful or, you know, relaxing and letting go of the stress, and, you know, it's just, you can't do it. You know, you have to. Sometimes you have to have behavioral change. In that situation, he needs to stop lying if he's going to be serious about developing the kind of deep sensitivity that comes with mindfulness. But your question is, you know, much broader than that. You know, how do we negotiate? How does Buddhism or Buddhist practice help in the stresses of work life and daily life? And I think what Genevieve said was really to the point of that, is that if we bring attention, very careful attention, to our life, that our life will become a lot clearer. We'll understand. There's many ways in which it'll help, but one of the most powerful ways, I think, or useful ways, is by seeing more clearly what's actually happening, we're going to be less caught by what's happening. If you have enough clear seeing of what's happening, you won't get stressful by things around you. So we develop our capacity to see clearly, to recognize clearly what's happening right now. Does that make sense?
So do you think that's... Like, what I was trying to tell you is that how does meditation help you conforming to that kind of clarity or seeing clearly? You know, having a transparent outlook, you know, like... Well, while we meditate, sometimes we have conflicting thoughts, right? We have, as you said, our mind is ahead of us in the body. How do you think that kind of, how does meditation can help, you know, will help us in resolving that, you know, that kind of a conflicting thoughts in our mindset?
Yeah, a couple of ways. So there are many, many answers to what you're saying, what you're asking, but two simple ways is that one of the classic benefits of meditation is it makes the mind and the body calmer. And if you become calmer, then you can see more clearly. The other benefit is that aside from any benefit of calm, what we're doing in meditation is developing the ability to see more clearly what's happening in the present moment. And as we develop that ability, it's like a skill, like a muscle, we get stronger. We bring that muscle with us into our daily life. So in our daily life also, we can see more clearly what's going on. So we don't get stressed to begin with.
So in other words, meditation helps you to see clearly.
Oh, yes. The Buddhist word for the kind of meditation we do here is vipassana. And passana means to see. And vi is kind of like a strengthener. And some people translate it as clear seeing. That's what we're practicing, is clear seeing. And you develop clear seeing by clear seeing. It's like you learn to, you know, you develop your running by running, right? You don't develop your running by playing cards. So we develop clear seeing. So it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing because it means that the very act, it's almost like the goal and the means are the same in a way. The very thing we're trying to develop is the thing we're doing to develop it. So I saw a hand in the back. Yes.
What I was going to say is that I'm a lawyer and I don't lie.
Good. Yeah. I was being very careful to say in his particular place, right?
But as I've been practicing with meditation, when I go into negotiations now, what I can do is, I usually get caught up in things, and then what I can do is actually say, you know, pull myself back and say, wait a minute, I'm going to just try a little bit of meditation here while they're labbing on or whatever. It's amazing. I mean, you see things more clearly, and as when you step away and become an observer, even in your own negotiation, it tremendously helps everything. And so I've actually seen the practicality of it in terms of lawyering.
I'm convinced of it. Maria?
Well, I'm not quite sure how to talk about this, but I'm going to try. And it is in response to what he asked. All week I've been really dealing with a huge amount of anger that I've had in a very stressful situation. And yesterday afternoon, I realized I was angry again, and I walked out of the room. I left the room. The meeting was going on, and I went to an empty room, and I sat down. And I thought of, and I meditated, and I thought about whether I should just dissipate this anger, get rid of this anger so I could go back and participate in the meeting. And I decided instead of doing that, that I would just sit there with that anger. And the interesting thing that happened is that because I was observing that anger, I became dissociated from it, in the sense that the anger was in me, and I recognized the anger in me. I felt the anger in me, but I was not the anger. And that was very liberating for me. And then I was able to go back. The anger didn't go away. I didn't, because I didn't chase it away. But I had a different relationship to the anger. And that was a very, it had a very positive effect for me. I wasn't trying to justify the anger. I wasn't trying to chase it away. I wasn't feeding it in any way. And that was very unique for me, to just watch it and recognize it and realize that I was not the anger.
So you,
it was just there.
So you weren't entangled with it anymore then?
I wasn't entangled with it.
Beautiful.
It did not control me.
Beautiful.
It was very different.
Beautiful. Yeah, yeah, I'm not a great... sometimes I'm angry, it seems the useful thing is to try to dissipate the anger. That's like the right call. But there are times where that doesn't feel like the right call. And supports my thinking about what the problem is. And I can sometimes think much more clearly if I walk, you know, while I'm angry. I don't try to dissipate it quickly. And sometimes I can, you know, then well, finally there's some real clarity that then maybe I'll go back and talk about it with the person. But I think also when I walk with my anger, I think that I'm letting it kind of course through me, but I don't think I'm identified with it. I think it, in a sense, I kind of borrow its energy to for more careful reflection. Yes.
One of the things I was wondering about is, do you find it essential to meditate every day? And when you were first starting your practice, did you have a difficult time establishing a daily meditation practice?
It's absolutely not essential to meditate every day, but it's phenomenally useful. And if you want to strengthen and develop your mindfulness and your presence and your compassion, it's phenomenally useful to meditate every day. It's very powerful to do it. I had some difficulties with my... And I strongly encourage people to sit every day. I think it's more powerful in the long term to sit every day than it is to never sit on a daily basis, but then to go periodically on meditation retreats. Some people do it that way. They don't sit every day, but they go just once a year, twice a year, they go on a 10-day retreat. That's the way their meditation practice kind of career works. But I think in the long term, it's actually much more powerful to sit every day than it is even to go on retreat. Best is to do both. So my experience was it difficult for me to start a meditation practice. The greatest difficulty I had when I was starting early on was not the motivation to sit, but I was living together with a couple. We were living on a farm. And we were the only people there, just the three of us, and we were farming and taking care of the cows, and so we knew each other pretty well. We were pretty close, and we were our only company was the three of us. And I started doing a daily sitting practice every morning, and I would go milk the cows, and then I'd go and sit, and then I would go down to breakfast with them, And my meditation wasn't particularly, you know, wasn't anything to boast about. It was just I was just sitting, but it gave me a kind of a sense of contentment with myself. I just felt content with life and myself, and So I'd come down to breakfast contented. And in a contented state, I didn't feel like I had to be myself even. I didn't have to kind of present myself in any way or make conversation I was just there. I was happy to be there. And here I was eating breakfast with them and didn't feel like I had to say anything and be anything for anybody. And I noticed that over the days that it started getting kind of tense at breakfast because they expected the old guilt to be there and they couldn't quite understand this new kind of peacefulness or contentment. And maybe for them it was like they associated that with being aloof or unfriendly or something. And I never asked them about it, but I could feel the tension. And I felt, I don't know if it was accurate, but I felt that I had to make a choice between either continuing to sit or keeping my friends. Either I had to stop sitting to keep my friends or I had to lose my friends in order to keep sitting. And so I chose to give up sitting. And I probably stopped for probably 6 months or something like that, 5-6 months until I left and moved and went off to college. And then when I got to college, then I rented a little garage where I lived. I lived in the garage, and I think I was paying, $50 a month. And then I was just ready to go start sitting. It wasn't difficult for me. I just sat twice a day, 40 minutes each morning, evening, just sat. I remember I was sitting in the garage, and I was doing Zazen, Zen practice, where you keep your eyes open. And I started noticing these black stuff kind of whizzing by. And I didn't know much about meditation. I thought, oh, this is just like a meditation phenomena, like an hallucination or something, just you see things, right, the unusual things. And then finally one day I looked, and it was a mouse. So I'm not answering your question then, but... So that was my experience. Other people have other difficulties with starting a daily sitting practice. Some people, it's the motivation. Other things can seem phenomenally more important than meditating. Meditating, you're not accomplishing anything, right? I mean, you can do it. You're not writing the great American novel, or you're not defrosting the freezer, or you're not, clearing the garage. Or there's all these really important things to be done that have to be done right now, right? And so it's very hard sometimes to have the motivation to sit feel strong enough to overcome, all the pulls of our daily life that seem so phenomenally important. So it's important to really reflect on your intention and reflect on what's really most fundamentally important. And so that meditation really feels like it's really something precious and valuable. And if you can't find within you that your meditation practice has some real deep value and is really precious and in and of itself, or at least you're going to give it the benefit of the doubt for a while as you experiment with it, if you can't find that in it, if you can't imagine that, or find that within you, then you're probably better off just forgetting it. Do something else. Yes?
Would you repeat that, please?
I think it's very important to connect your spiritual practice, your meditation practice, with that which is most important in your life, your deepest intention, your deepest wish for your life, among the deepest things you want for yourself in your life. And if it's just a superficial thing you're doing, you're just doing it for a little bit, it's kind of a nice thing to do, and it's kind of cool. Buddhism is kind of cool, and it's the latest, hottest thing, or there's a lot of kind of reasons a person can do it. But if you really want to sustain it in a way that really goes deeply in your life, I think it helps if it's really deeply connected to something that's really important for you, either directly or indirectly. And if you don't find some connection with some real deep preciousness of your life, some deep, precious, or important intention or wish you have for your life, then maybe you're better off just not even doing it. Do something else. Find something else that's precious. Life is really precious, so, find what's really important for you and follow through on that. Oh. I thought we were just not... Time goes. Let me ask you a question, if I may. I've started to lead guided meditations through many of the Thursday sittings now, more than I used to. And I would like to have some feedback from that. And so maybe a couple of you can say something now, but maybe some of you would like to tell me afterwards whether that works for you, you like it, or you want more quiet and silence, or more of a balance between it. Or I'm kind of into it, doing it this way now, but I'd like, you know, I'd like to hear from you, because it'll change.
I like it because I try to meditate every day at home, except for the days I come here. And there, it isn't guided, except that sometimes I go through a body scan or something like that. And so this sort of complements that. I was thinking it was a good thing for me.
Thank you. Yes.
I think it's excellent. It's an enormous help for someone like me who has trouble with the long period of silence. It keeps me much more connected. It's very good.
I learn something new each time. I really like it if you do it because it so, gives so much variety compared to what I do myself. I feel a little more interesting myself, I guess.
It can be helpful to be playful when you do meditation.
Especially when you broaden into who you are, that was really
great.
One of the things that you probably think that was right in the room.
Yes.
Yes, I found it very useful as well. And I wondered, did you, I hope, hopefully that was recorded?
No.
Oh, it wasn't. Oh.
So, those of you who don't like it, why don't you come and tell me afterwards? Since the direction seems to be people like it, but I would like to hear, you know, I really want to hear, and I could really respect someone who doesn't like it, because I used to hate it when people did it when I was sitting. So, Lewis doesn't like it. So well, you know, we'll do a variety, and it's kind of intuitive on my part of how much we do and what we do and what I feel is useful, and so hopefully you'll go along or trust me as I kind of feel our way as a group of how what seems appropriate or what is called for. So anyway, we should stop. I want to thank you all, and I wish you much happiness for the week.